All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And good to be here today, I tell you. And it's good to be, just starting out with this song. It always drives me crazy. And starting right on the dime like it usually does. That's a good feeling and a good sign. Towards the back end of the show, and a reflection, a concentration of what the hell is going on in the world today and how the world is so rapidly developing, we're going to be having Larry Everest, the writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Rocking the U.S. Global Agenda, back to talk with us about the situation in Egypt following the removal of Morsi by the Egyptian army, the Egyptian president Morsi by the Egyptian army. And in the middle of the show, we're going to be talking about a question that is getting posed very, very sharply these days. Everybody knows that Nelson Mandela, the first black president of South Africa and one of the leaders of the African National Congress and a prominent figure in the struggle to end apartheid in South Africa, is very ill and may be dying in a hospital in South Africa. And right now, the entire world is focused up around this and in one way or another is confronting some very big questions about exactly how do you change a very repressive, oppressive society to something that's actually worth living in, to a more liberated society. And to speak to that, we're going to be listening to a segment from a talk that Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, gave back in 2003. And this segment focuses up on the role of people like Gandhi, Mandela, Martin Luther King, and Cesar Chavez in the struggle to change society. And opening the show up, I'm really happy to welcome to the show Andy Worthington. And Andy is one of the founders of CloseGuantanamo.org. He's also a journalist and the author of, basically he's the foremost expert in the world on Guantanamo and the situation of the people in Guantanamo, what's happening to the people being held there, and the struggle to close Guantanamo. He's also the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. Andy, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be back.
Yeah, you too, man. Good to talk with you. As I was preparing for this, as I was reading all this stuff and thinking about it, I kept thinking, damn, man, this has been so long that we've been talking about this, you know? It's something that really, really beats on your head for a while. And especially because I was looking at this and this is like day 150.
Yeah.
This is an incredible, this is a landmark in terms of the prison hunger strike. These guys have been on a hunger strike for 5 months.
Yeah.
This is almost unheard of. And I wanted you to give people, when I wrote to you about being on the show again today, I mentioned the fact that for a while, there was a flurry of attention concentrated on what was happening with the hunger strike. Then Obama gives a speech, and then things sort of receded in terms of the attention being paid, particularly in this country, the attention being paid to what's going on in Guantanamo. So can you give us sort of an update on what is happening with the detainees and with the hunger strike?
Well, it's horrible, Michael. And, it is terrible that the media has largely moved on again. We actually had the mainstream media of the world, and all the decent newspapers in the U.S. Very few broadcasters, but we had people on the case for two months solid. I think from when it became apparent that there was a serious prison-wide hunger strike, and suddenly everybody remembered why these men might be, starving themselves to death to get the world to see their plight. Until President Obama made his speech, and like you say, him making his speech kind of switched the tap off. We're going to have to mobilize again if we see no action, because the guys are, all in lockdown in Guantanamo. They're all in solitary. That's the result of a dawn raid on a Saturday morning back in April, I think it was, when the authorities decided that they had to take back control of the prison from the prisoners who, have been, most of them were held in Camp 6, which was a prison that had communal areas where they had been allowed to mingle. They had this violent dawn raid and just shut down everything and locked everybody up in solitary. So what you have now is, an entirely, a prison devoid of any, communal experiences amongst the prisoners. So we're back to the worst days of Bush. And all that's happening to these guys is that, for 45 of them, that's the number that are being force-fed, then twice a day they're pulled out of their solitary cells and strapped into the restraint chairs and force-fed, which, is a horrible experience that, medical professionals describe as torture and say shouldn't be happening to mentally competent prisoners. But of course, you know, I understand that the authorities don't willingly want to let people die when they can keep them alive, however horrible the means are. But, you know, what a terrible situation to be in after all this time. And the answer, of course, is that, you know, there is a political solution to this, and that's to free some of these men. Over half of them have been cleared for release for at least 3.5 years, which was when President Obama's interagency Guantanamo Review Task Force said, you know, these are all guys that we have no desire to try or to keep holding forever. So, you know, it's down to the president. He has obstruction from Congress, but those are the only two players in the game.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Worthington, a journalist and author and foremost expert in the world on the Guantanamo torture chamber. You know, Andy, it's you know, I was just thinking about this when we were talking about how long people have been in Guantanamo, and the fact that there are so many people that have been cleared for release. There's so many, you know, and there's so many things that have come out. And it really is, frankly, it seems like the only reason that people are paying any attention to Guantanamo is because of the actions of the prisoners themselves and even being kept in the most horrendous conditions. And then you have this situation, you know, you have this situation where you're looking at it and you're thinking, okay, these guys are held there, and just recently, wasn't it revealed that something like only 12 of the prisoners who were there are actually ever going to face trial?
Yeah, well, that's according to the chief prosecutor of the military commissions. His estimate is that a maximum of 12 of the remaining 166 prisoners will ever face a trial, yeah. And, you know, and that's partly because the trial system, the military commissions at Guantanamo, have had what little legitimacy they had was seriously eroded last fall and early this year. By two rulings, by the D.C. Circuit Court, a notoriously conservative right-wing court in Washington D.C. Appeals Court, which basically, you know, scrubbed out two of the only convictions achieved in the military commission, saying, you know, you convicted these guys of war crimes that weren't war crimes, which, frankly, everybody knew all along.
You know, one of the things I saw on your website, actually, one of the things I saw is that there's been actual recent legal actions taken by at least four of the detainees, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell people about that?
Well, you know, the prisoners are asking the court to intervene on their behalf, to tell the government that what the government is doing is unacceptable and to stop force-feeding the prisoners, thereby, you know, forcing the administration to find a political solution, the political solution which is the only way out of this. Now, the government has responded, and typically, you know, this is a depressing story that nobody really knows about, Michael. These are lawyers in the civil division of the Justice Department. These are the guys who've, you know, who they were there under Bush, and they're still there under Obama, and it's their job, it seems to me, to try and do everything in their power to prevent any prisoner from Guantanamo being released. You know, they always have argued the habeas corpus petitions of the prisoners to say, you know, these guys shouldn't be released. And sure enough, here are these same guys, you know, the old holdovers from the Bush days, arguing that, you know, the judge has no right to tell the government what to do, and that they only have the prisoners' best interests in heart. You know, all stuff that's really, really, frankly, quite hard to believe. You know, they're trying to avoid a PR disaster. It turns out that, you know, Ramadan is starting next week, Michael, on the 8th of July. And so the prisoners who are on a hunger strike don't want to be force-fed in the daylight hours when they would normally, if they were eating, not be eating. So, you know, they've also been trying to get assurances from the administration that they won't be force-fed in the daytime, which would, you know, be about as insulting a thing as you could possibly do during Ramadan to a Muslim. And the authorities seem to be saying that they are going to do that. And the lawyers who brought this case to the district court this week have come back just today and said, we don't really see how you're going to be able to force-feed all these people that are on a hunger strike and need force-feeding in the nighttime hours. They described it as a force-feeding factory. They say that, you know, throughout Ramadan, you're going to have this time at night when there's going to be this, you know, massive program of force-feeding prisoner after prisoner. A force-feeding factory, I thought, was a very powerful description of quite how horrible everything is at the moment.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Worthington, journalist and author and foremost expert in the world on the Guantanamo torture chamber.
You know, one of the things that people don't realize, I think, even as many times as we say it, when I was reading the quotes from the detainees that are on your website, I was really struck by the fact that force feeding is in fact really torture. You know, when you read the descriptions that people are talking about what happens to them as they're being force fed and even how they're being and the process of actually carrying that out. Can you just give people a sense of that? Because I don't think a lot of people know that.
Well, you know, they shove this tube down. They're strapped into a restraint chair using, I believe, 6 straps. And then this tube is pushed up their nose and into their stomach. So, you know, just that's very painful. And then a liquid nutrient is forced through this small tube. And the prisoners all say that that it's very, very painful when this stuff is coming into their system. And it seems to be that it makes a lot of them vomit or that they feel that they're going to vomit. But prisoners do vomit. And if they do, then they're subjected to the whole thing again. You know, and I believe that sometimes prisoners soil themselves as well. It's such an intrusive and painful procedure. So, yeah, I mean, there's not any way you can really put a positive spin on that, is there? I mean, the administration, you know, is claiming that they're, you know, benevolently trying to keep these prisoners alive, but they're overlooking the fact that the prisoners have said the quality of our lives are so poor, are so wretched. You know, our hopes have been dashed entirely, that we don't want this terrible life. That's why we're starving ourselves. So there are layers of irony, I think, in this that are just so unpleasant. And as I keep saying, I mean, it's interesting and it's necessary to talk about this whole process of the force feeding. But we always have to remember that there is a political solution behind it, and that we're waiting for President Obama to act. And he can act now. I mean, much as Congress has raised obstacles to try and prevent him releasing prisoners, there is a waiver in the particular legislation that allows him, if it's in the national security interests of the United States, to release prisoners without dealing with Congress. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and he's the one who said back on May the 23rd in this major speech that he gave on national security when he promised to start releasing prisoners again, he explained why it was in the national security interests of the United States to not have this prison exist anymore. He was extremely eloquent about explaining that. So the power really is absolutely in his hands to do something that would definitely ease the pressure in Guantanamo, would be the only thing that the prisoners are saying would make them think twice about the path that they're on, is to see prisoners released from the prison.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Worthington, a journalist and author, and he's probably the person who has done more to focus attention, besides the prisoners themselves, on the situation in Guantanamo, the torture situation, the situation that should not be tolerated, and the struggle of the prisoners and people around the world to stop this. Andy, you know, let me say one thing here, too. And let me also tell people, because I want people to go to this site, theclosedguantanamo.org. Extremely important that people go there and check out what you guys are doing. You and Tom Wilner, who's one of the lawyers for some of the detainees in Guantanamo. You know, this is extremely important for people to keep up on this. And I want to talk more about this, sort of the responsibility of the different branches of government. I also though want to get back to one thing before we get into that. There's a point here that I read that I wasn't aware of, which is that a lot of the prisoners are now talking about how there's a certain medication that's being applied or being included in when they get force-fed. Without their consent, they're being medicated with this thing. What is it, Reglan?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And that's not that good of a medicine, is it?
Well, no, apparently it isn't. Apparently it has some pretty horrible psychological side effects. But, you know, I mean, this is part of a long-running story that, you know, the administration and its representatives have never, ever come clean on the story of what's actually happening with medication. Whether you know, there may plausibly be some explanation whereby they, they're actually doing things that are for the benefit of the prisoners. But there, over the years, there have regularly been stories about them using drugs that have dangerous psychological side effects. And certainly, over the years, prisoners have spoken about feeling that they were subjected to medication that made them feel extremely strange. You know, I mean, my colleague Jeff Kay, who I don't know whether you've spoken to, Michael, but who lives on the West Coast and is a psychologist, but has done a lot of work looking into what the story is of the medication at Guantanamo believes that it's essentially a continuation of a long fascination that the American authorities have had with human experimentation. And, you know, I would find it very hard to refute that. You know, in terms of the latest incidents of what's happening with the prisoners, we've had a blanket denial from the Justice Department lawyers in their response to the motion that was filed this week on behalf of the four prisoners. But, you know, what's that worth? You know, they will always deny anything that sounds contentious about Guantanamo. These are people who, you know, claimed they never tortured people. So I think it's very worrying what's happening. And yeah. I think the demand that was put to the administration just a few weeks ago by a number of doctors from around the world to allow independent medical personnel into Guantanamo to see the prisoners' medical records and to make their own unbiased and objective advice about what would be best for them is a very good way forward. But clearly, you know, the administration has no intention of allowing that to happen.
Right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Worthington, journalist, author, and expert on the Guantanamo torture chamber, and we're talking about the ongoing hunger strike at Guantanamo. Now, let's move into this one thing. We have about 5 minutes left, and I really want to cover this hard, because we've talked about, look, you know, the point that Obama can release these folks. He's not doing it. We've talked about a lot of other factors going here, but one thing that you've talked about recently that I thought was very important was you focused a little bit on the fact that the judiciary has just as much responsibility for what's happening to the prisoners in Guantanamo as every other branch of the government, that there's actually been a lot going on there that's been designed to keep this, to keep these folks in prison, to keep the train running along. Talk about that a little.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, this goes back to a long-running struggle on the part of the prisoners to have rights. That when they were initially in prison, they had no rights whatsoever, literally. And then, you know, 2.5 years later, after a long legal struggle, the Supreme Court granted them habeas corpus rights. That was in 2004. They were then taken away by Congress. And then in 2008, the Supreme Court revisited the prisoners' cases and insisted that, yes, they had habeas corpus rights, and Congress had acted unconstitutionally in taking them away. So, you know, they got access to lawyers. That's always been an important lifeline for the men there. That happened in 2004. The first visits were in 2005. And in 2008, they started getting their habeas corpus petitions looked at by judges. And we had an interesting, and really great period for a couple of years where the judges were impartially examining the evidence and concluding that the government had no evidence that these guys were connected with either Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. They understood that what purported to be evidence was a assemblage of rubbish, essentially, derived through torture, other forms of abuse, bribing prisoners, and just incompetence. You know, and then what happened was that the D.C. Circuit Court started fighting back. So a number of very, very right-wing judges in that court started rewriting the rules, essentially to say, you know, you have to believe everything the government says unless you can prove that it isn't true. So the prisoners who are locked up in Guantanamo with no access to anything are now required to prove the government wrong. Any nonsense the government comes up with is supposed to be regarded as accurate. And then the prisoners haven't won a case since then. And the Supreme Court in 2011 and 2012 had the opportunity. There were petitions from a number of prisoners saying, please, address our concerns. They tried all kinds of different angles about why the denial of their habeas petitions had been wrong. And both times the Supreme Court has refused to get involved. And so they, from this position where the Justice Stevens-led court had been giving rights to the prisoners, the court that we now have, the Supreme Court under Obama, is one that refuses to get involved. It has allowed decisions, legal decisions about the prisoners and the rules for their detention to be taken over completely from them. And, and are being directed by this handful of very right-wing judges in the D.C. Circuit Court. And, you know, I think that's absolutely disgraceful. I think they have completely abdicated their responsibility that they embraced in 2004 and in 2008, but there's no sign of that. And to be honest, I think it's partly, as I say, because Justice Stevens retired, and the court that we now have that has a couple of Obama nominees may be good on all kinds of other issues, but is absolutely useless on national security issues involving aspects of the war on terror.
apparently it's not that good on voting rights for black people and other oppressed nationalities in the U.S. either. You know, that's a Andy or many other things. I got to tell you, man, this is not a walk in the park here. All right, Andy, I gotta wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us. And I want you to tell people your websites.
Well, my website is andyworthington.co.uk, and the Close Guantanamo website is closeguantanamo.org. And we have a page there called Join Us. If you just send us an email, then you're counted as supporting the mission that we're on to one day be able to say, we close this place and let's never do that again.
All right, Andy, thank you very much for joining us. And as much as I love talking with you, man, unfortunately, I think I'm going to have you back relatively soon to keep people's eyes focused on this, all right?
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, Andy.
All right.
Take care, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Andy Worthington, author and journalist and one of the foremost experts on the Guantanamo torture chamber and all the people being held in it. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to an excerpt of a speech by Bob Avakian on why not bring about change peacefully. Welcome back. And that's that song. I've got to tell you, this is one of my favorite songs. It's Ballad for the Black Man from David Murray. Now, this section of the show, you know, Nelson Mandela is currently very ill and maybe dying in a hospital in South Africa. And Mandela is known throughout the world as a beacon of morality and courage and all that stuff. He's also the man who was the first black president of South Africa and a longtime activist and leader in the struggle to end apartheid in South Africa. Well, the situation with Mandela today has focused up a lot of attention on critical questions about how to change society. In particular, people advocating that the path Mandela chose is actually the best way to change society. In fact, maybe the only way to do it in any rational sense. So I thought, since this question is being focused up for discussion and a lot of people are thinking about it, that it'd be good to listen to an excerpt from a speech that Bob Avakian gave back in 2003. Now, the overall speech is called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And you can get that by Googling Revolution Talk, all right? And I think the site is revolutiontalk.net. And this section of the speech is called, Why Not Bring About Change Peacefully?
Now this gets to a big thing that many people raise. Why not bring about change peacefully? Why not follow the path of Gandhi in India or Mandela in South Africa, the path of Martin Luther King or someone like Cesar Chavez? First, let's keep in mind the nature of this system and those who rule it. Everything that I've spoken to from the beginning and throughout this talk, all of experience throughout the world and throughout history shows that ruling classes like this will not allow any kind of fundamental change peacefully. It shows that they have used and will continue to use the most bloody and bloodthirsty means that they can to try to beat down any attempt at serious change. And certainly this is true of any real revolution, any struggle to wrest power from them and to radically change all of society and the world, which they now dominate and exploit and are determined to continue dominating and exploiting. In discussing this, we have to get to a very basic point. People raise, but violence is degrading. All violence is degrading. It makes you into the very thing that you're fighting against. This is simply not true. Let's look at different kinds of violence and see if they're all the same. Let's say you're out on the street and somebody pulls out a knife, robs you and cuts you up and leaves you bleeding. That's one kind of violence that's degrading and oppressive. But let's say you go to a doctor and the doctor discovers that you have stomach cancer. And the doctor says you need an operation and you say, okay, you go in the operating room. They put you under anesthesia and the doctor cuts you open. That's bloody. There's blood all over the place. Go to an operating room if you don't believe me. That's a form of violence. There's blood all over the place. They're cutting you open too. But it's very different than the person who robs you and cuts you on the street. One of them is taking away something from you and taking away some of your humanity. Another one is saving your life. But let's look at an even more clear example. I talked earlier about these horrendous examples of lynching and rape. Well, let's say that you were living in the South in this period when all these lynchings were going on, and you were with a group of people, and you came upon a crowd that had taken someone like a Claude Neal or a Haynes Turner or a Mary Turner, and they were getting ready, for example, to burn Mary Turner alive. And there were a group of you there. Would you say, oh, I can't do anything about that. I can't get people together here. I can't even go get guns and put a stop to this, because if I did that, I'd be just as degraded as the people who are carrying out this lynching. You'd be a fool to say something like that. You'd be very, very misguided at the very best. And you would let a horrible thing happen in the name of not becoming what you're fighting. But you're not becoming what you're fighting by stopping a lynching. You're doing something radically different. And of course, much better. Well, how about a rape? Let's say you round a corner. It's dark at night. You hear a cry and you run over and you see a woman being attacked and raped. And you say, well, I can't do anything about that because I'd have to use violence to stop that. This rapist has shown that he's determined not to stop. He's got a knife or a gun. He's going to go ahead with this. He's telling me to get the fuck out of here or he'll shoot me. But I can't do anything about that because I don't want to become like the rapist. If I use violence to stop that rapist, I'll be just as bad as... No, that's crazy. And anybody can see that that's crazy. Those different kinds of violence have very different content and different meaning. One of them is enforcing oppression and degradation. The other is moving to free people from oppression and degradation. They're not at all the same, and they're not all degrading. One is degrading, and one is uplifting. Violence to throw off oppression, to make revolution, is not at all the same. It's very different, radically different, than violence to maintain and enforce oppression. Now, I'm not talking about any old kind of violence. Here, people just run off and do things crazy, or especially commit violence against each other. We've had way too much of that, and that serves them way too much. I'm talking about resistance and rebellion against oppression, and most of all, I'm talking about a real, conscious, organized, revolutionary struggle to end the system which perpetrates and perpetuates this oppression and degradation over and over and over again. Now let's talk about what did and what did not happen in India with Gandhi. The mythology that we're told is that Gandhi led this mass, nonviolent, peaceful struggle which finally forced the English colonialists to give up in India and to give the Indian people their own rule over their own country. That's a fabrication and a myth that's been perpetuated by the very colonialists and imperialists. How did India become nominally, in words only, independent? The fact is that as a result of World War II, British colonialism was too weakened to hang on to much of its empire. You know how they used to brag, the British colonialists? Our empire is so great that the sun never sets on it. When the sun is setting in Ireland, it's rising in Egypt and India. So the sun never sets on our empire. It's so great and stretches over so much of the world. And now they're reduced to foggy old, gray, dreary England. Their empire. They're still trying to f*** around in the world, and they're still imperialists, but they don't have an empire that the sun never sets on. In fact, they hardly ever see the sun. But when faced with this situation, the British colonialists decided that the only way they could pursue their imperialist interests was by completely hitching their wagon to American imperialism.
You're listening to an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And the subject of this excerpt is, why not bring about change peacefully?
Have you ever noticed how every time U.S. imperialism does anything, if nobody else in the entire world supports it, the British will support it? They got the big dog and the little chihuahua running side by side. Woof, woof, woof. Yip, 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 yip. Because after World War II, when it recognized that it was too weakened to pursue its own imperialist interests in the same way it had before, the English ruling class in its great majority decided, let's become junior partners running alongside the U.S. And as part of this whole thing, in the face of a massive anti-colonial struggle that was developing throughout all the formerly colonized world, they decided to change the form of imperialist domination in India, grant it formal independence, f*** up everybody by creating Pakistan as an Islamic country, and India as a supposed Hindu country, and all this other mess, and basically allow the U.S. imperialists to come in and have domination over it, with the English getting their cut in there as junior partners. That's what actually happened. What Gandhi did not lead to independence. It had nothing to do with what actually resulted after World War II. And it certainly was not the reason why the British colonialists stepped back and let the U.S. imperialists come in, and why India ever since, down to today, has been fought over and ravaged by different competing imperialist powers, particularly the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And now that the Soviet Union is gone in that form, the U.S. in particular is ravaging India still. And what's happening inside of India? What are the conditions like there for the masses of people? All the kinds of things that I talked about that exist in Nepal, for example, for the women, also hold true in India. And for the masses of people, particularly the peasants in the countryside, their conditions are horrendous. The oppression, the poverty, the exploitation, the domination by larger interests and by imperialism is horrendous. It has never been relieved. It has never been certainly abolished by anything that Gandhi did. It has continued for decades, right down to today, since World War II. Look at some of the things that go on in India. For example, the situation of women once again. Here is a perverse situation where you get this combination of extreme high tech and extremely backward oppressive conditions linked together. What happens in India, all over the country, for example, is that high tech means of ultrasound are used during the pregnancy of a woman to determine if the baby is going to be a boy or a girl. And if it's going to be a girl, there's tremendous pressure to abort it because girls are considered less value than boys and really of not much value at all. Now, this is very different than the right of women on their own to decide to have an abortion in order to be able to take part freely in society. In fact, this form of killing fetuses that are girls once they're determined to be girls is all part of the same package of oppression of women that goes along with denying women the right to abortion. But this is an extremely backward form of it in India. And this is just one sign of what the conditions are like for the billion people or so that live in India down to today. Gandhi changed none of that. Well, look at the caste system in India. Today, they still have the caste system. You can read books and novels about it. The horrendous things that are done to people, and even though it's supposed to be done away with, the horrendous things that are done to people in the so-called untouchable castes, if they dare to come into contact with or to do things out of order in relation to people of a higher caste, I won't even go into some of the details. Read about it. It's tremendously oppressive and degrading. None of this has been changed in India. None of what Gandhi did had any effect on this. It's a mythology that's been created to tell people that this is the way you can change things when it's a dead end and a trap for people. And the same is true in South Africa, even after Nelson Mandela became president there. Apartheid, a system of open segregation and terror against the African people, has been formally abolished. It's gone in that form. But white supremacy and imperialist domination have remained, and in some ways have even been strengthened. Land and the rich resources in and under the land have remained in the hands of rich white owners and imperialists, who together still hold the real power in South Africa, even though members of the African National Congress may be elected to the presidency. The conditions of the masses of people, of African people in that country, farmers deprived of land or forced to remain on dirt poor land, miners and millions living in urban slums and shanty towns, their conditions have remained the same or have even gotten worse. Now, Arundhati Roy, a brilliant writer from India, who is also an activist in the fight against imperialism, or empire as she calls it, has also painted a vivid picture of this. In a speech earlier this year at the Riverside Church in Harlem, she pointed out that after Nelson Mandela's African National Congress became the party in office in South Africa, they bowed to the imperialist system, its international market, and its international institutions of financial control. And the result is that this has, in Arundhati Roy's words, increased the hideous disparities between the rich and the poor. More than 1 million people have lost their jobs. 10 million South Africans, almost a quarter of the population, have been disconnected from water and electricity. 2 million have been evicted from their homes. Meanwhile, a small white minority that has been historically privileged by centuries of brutal exploitation is more secure than ever before. It's apartheid with a clean conscience, and it goes by the name of democracy. This is a very insightful comment by Arundhati Roy. Gets very much to the truth of things. Now, I should say that Roy does not recognize, at least not yet, the kind of revolution that is really needed to change all this fundamentally. But the way in which she is contributing to the exposure of the conditions of the people and the crimes of the system is very valuable. And hopefully she and many others like her will more and more come to see the need for and embrace communist revolution, which is the only thing that can actually lead to abolishing these horrendous things and bringing about real liberation for the oppressed all over the world.
You're listening to an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And the subject of this excerpt is, why not bring about change peacefully?
Well, what about what was done by Cesar Chavez, and where did that lead? Most of you know that Cesar Chavez was a leader of the farm workers during the 60s. The conditions of the farm workers in California and other places at that time were horrific. Working in the fields long hours, brutally oppressed, denied basic rights, discriminated against, not even allowed to have a union. And a massive movement did develop in which Cesar Chavez played a leading role. And this movement drew broad support from Chicanos and Latinos throughout society and even more broadly among people who stand up for justice and against oppression. And some changes were made. And the union was won there, and some rights were recognized, and some conditions were bettered for a short time for a section of the farm workers. But in order to prove that he was working within the mainstream, and that by working within the mainstream you could improve the conditions of some of the workers, following that strategy, Cesar Chavez was forced to do horrible things. One of the most horrible is that he actually turned in illegal immigrants in the fields in order to try to win legitimacy in the eyes of the ruling class for his union. And this led down a certain path. And what are the conditions of the farm workers today? We just had an article in the most recent issue of our paper about the conditions in the fields. A group of writers went to Fresno and interviewed farm workers. The conditions are the same or worse as they were once Cesar Chavez first began that movement. And what happened with Martin Luther King? He insisted once again on the path of nonviolence, at least for the people fighting against oppression. And this led him to do terrible things too. For example, during the urban rebellions of the 1960s, Martin Luther King actually called and signed a letter to the president, Johnson, calling on the army and troops to be sent in to put down these rebellions. And what happened when the army and federal troops came in to put down these rebellions. Let's look at Detroit in 1967, one of the greatest rebellions of the time. I talked earlier about even the concessions it wrenched out of the auto companies. But the other side of this is when the army came in, and together with the police, they didn't just shoot people down in the street. They rounded people up and murdered them in cold blood. Some of this took place in a motel called the Algiers Motel near Detroit. They took people there and lined them up and executed a number of them in cold blood for taking part in the rebellion. This is what will always happen if you call for the army of the oppressors to come in and put down the uprising of the people, because you have the view that any kind of violence by the oppressed people will either degrade them or will put them in a situation where the full force of the state will come down on them, so you call for the state to come down on them. But as Mao Zedong pointed out, even with all this, and even though he was an advocate of nonviolence, the system did not spare Martin Luther King. They assassinated him. And what is the situation of the Chicano people and of black people today? Yes, there are some more sections of the middle class that have developed, but for a large section of the people, the conditions are the same or worse than they were in the 60s. And a revolution remains to be made to sweep away the system that holds them in these conditions. So we can see once again that the path of so-called peaceful resistance as a strategy, as the means and the limits of struggle to change things, not as a tactic here and there, but as a strategy and as the means and limits that are insisted upon in the struggle, that this cannot lead to the radical and profound changes that are needed. It cannot lead to real and complete liberation, to an overturning of all of society, to a whole different world and future for the masses of people and for humanity as a whole.
All right, you've just been listening to an excerpt of a speech by Bob Avakian, and the speech overall is called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About, and you can access that speech at revolutiontalk.net. And you can the chapter that you've been listening to is a chapter called Why Not Bring About Change Peacefully? And it takes a hard scientific look on the program and outlook of people like Gandhi, Mandela, Cesar Chavez, and Martin Luther King. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Larry Everest, journalist and author, about what the hell is going on in Egypt, so stay tuned. Welcome back, and that was Rashid Taha covering the Clash's Rock the Casbah. Joining us to talk about Egypt today is Larry Everest, a writer with Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
Yeah, we're going to push as much as we can into this right now. I think we have about maybe 17 minutes. I want to talk to you about what the hell is going on in Egypt. You know, it's like you're sitting here and you're watching this as it's going on. You're watching the rest of the world. You and I were just talking about Syria and all that's happening there. And then a week later, suddenly everything has changed dramatically in Egypt. What the hell is happening, Larry?
Well, listen, let's do a quick background here. For 30 years, the U.S. backed the military Mubarak government, which was essentially a military dictatorship, a pro-imperialist military dictatorship, part of the whole U.S. Imperialist structure in the Middle East. Then in January and February, 2 years ago, 2011, people had had enough. There was a massive uprising. Mubarak was removed from power, but there was no revolution. The essential pillars of the state remained in place, the military still exercising dominant power. Then over the next year, there was a complicated battle, but again, within the structure, the existing structure of imperialist domination and the rule by reactionary property capitalist forces and feudal forces. As a result of all that, in June 2012, an election was held, and Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood was put in power. Is an Islamist, also a reactionary, also a proponent of this same basic structure, although with with much more insertion of religion into the body politic, into daily life, into the legal system. This has led. And Morsi was increasingly trying to take more power into his own hands. The people in Egypt continued to suffer enormously. Their desire for liberation had not been met. And so there was really a gathering wave over the past year of unrest and unhappiness. And that culminated this past Sunday, June 30th, with millions of Egyptians pouring into the streets. People saw these pictures of Tahrir Square. I mean, you couldn't get within a mile of Tahrir Square because it was just the streets were full of people. The very next day, the Egyptian military, which was still in control, the armed forces and the police and all the levers of state power, the key levers of state power, issued an ultimatum to Morsi to go. Morsi refused, and on the 4th, the 3rd of July, or the 4th, the military did a coup and removed Morsi from power and have arrested a number of the Muslim Brotherhood, the top leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood. And, of course, there are millions of people from different social classes and walks of life who... many of them cheered this military action to get rid of Morsi, but things are very fluid and very tumultuous, and the desire of the Egyptian people for liberation remains unfulfilled.
Well, let me ask you this, Larry.
The structure of power remains in place.
All right, that's actually the point. That's the place where I wanted to start to go. And, with this, there's a whole scene. People remember there was a big thing that was going on when Mubarak was first overthrown, and there was that a lot of, heartfelt sentiment about the army was the people in the army are one hand, the people in the army are together in all this. Then when the army came in, there was a whole question of the massive repression that was unleashed against people, against opposition elements, including a lot of the people who were at one point cheering the army on. Then they had this election. This Islamic fundamentalist guy gets in. Now the army comes in, and I think it's worth talking about too in relation to this. The army did not just come in alone. There was actually. I want you to talk a little bit about the U.S. and what its role in all this is, and what its interests are, and how it's actually playing out. But also, what do we say about this? I mean, now you see people cheering. I was watching the helicopters flying over Tahrir Square with the Egyptian flags and people cheering and people carrying plainclothes cops on their shoulders and all this stuff. And there's this element, again, of rising of sort of like the army is on our side, and you're watching it. And it's on the one hand, it's a great thing that people are up in the streets and doing this kind of stuff. On the other hand, for things to go this way is really it doesn't bode well.
Well, look. I think the key thing is people have to disabuse themselves of several profound illusions or delusions. Number one, that democracy and voting is the answer, because Morsi was voted in. But people have to understand that voting and elections do not determine who has state power. Who has state power? Which class holds state power? And what social and economic relations that class represents determines the outcome of elections and even whether there are elections. So the first thing that needs to happen in Egypt is not another vote. What needs to happen in Egypt is a revolution that overthrows the pro-imperialist reactionary forces that have been oppressing Egypt for the last 40 years. That's what needs to happen. And new social forces, at the core of which the masses of people, and led by a communist vanguard party with an understanding that you need to uproot, you need to take state power, you need to dismantle the institutions of repression, you need to create a revolutionary state that backs up the masses in uprooting all the forms of oppression, patriarchy, capitalism, the sectarian violence against different religious or nationalist groups. That's what needs to happen. And you can, and here's the second illusion people need to disabuse themselves of, is that leaderless movements are any good. Leaderless movements just means somebody else is going to lead it, and these oppressive classes, like the Muslim Brotherhood, like the Egyptian military, they have leaders, they have organization, and if you're saying you're not going to forge organization and leadership, you're just saying that you're going to allow these horrific forces who have been crushing the lives and spirits of Egyptians for so long, you're going to allow them to maintain.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're talking about what's going on in Egypt.
Let's talk about the role of the U.S. in all this, because it's sort of, you know, they're kind of acting like, on the one hand, they're sort of like, oh, whoa, this took us by surprise. And, you know, this is we want the restoration of the democratic process. And at the same time, there's a lot of stuff that they did behind the scenes in terms of, and how does this fall out? Because, you know, on the one hand, they didn't really object to Morsi coming into power. They didn't really object to the military being in power in the first time around. What's the scene now?
Well, listen, Michael, Egypt is a teachable moment. People should really look at the last 2 years and think about what happened. The United States was fine with the removal of Mubarak because that was a better way to maintain their power. They got rid of the one figure that was hated by everybody, but they kept the military, which is at the core of their relationship. They give the Egyptian military $1.3 billion every year. That's the core conduit, if you will, of U.S. imperialist influence. The military remained dominant, but the U.S. realized that there had to be much more the appearance of inclusion, the appearance that people had a choice in things. So they encouraged the staging of the elections that happened in June 2012. I wrote an article called Egypt Liberation Not on the Ballot that went into some of the back and forth. But basically, no one was allowed to run in those elections except reactionary forces, either the candidate that was acceptable to the military or the Muslim Brotherhood. And you're right, the U.S. was perfectly willing to work with the Brotherhood. Why? Because the Brotherhood, and it exposes that Islamic fundamentalism has nothing different to offer the masses of people. The Morsi government backed the U.S., backed Egypt's continued backing of Israel. The Morsi government backed Egypt's continuing subordination in the division of the global capitalist division of labor. And it backed the maintenance of the power of the army and the various oppressive social relations in Egypt. So the U.S. didn't have a big problem with that. And there were, I won't go into it now, but they saw certain advantages in the region of aligning Sunni forces against Shiite, in a sense, fomenting sectarianism against Iran, which they consider the big problem in the region. But now, again, just as you say, the United States won't even call what the military did a coup because they understand that they will need to and they can work with the military, and that Morsi was becoming very unpopular. So again, it's maneuvering behind the scenes to maintain maintain the essential structures of power and imperialist domination. And I think that's how people should understand it.
Well, one thing that actually crops up, too, real quick, and we have about a minute and a half on this, but real quick, the idea that, you know, here we have a situation, again, where what's developing in Egypt, because even as I'm reading the paper this morning where the military opened fire on Morsi supporters, but then also there are people out there with Al-Qaeda flags, there's all these kinds of things, the Islamic fundamentalists, there's all this talk about, well, they could get really fired up around this, and this actually does sort of ratchet things up in terms of the contradictions that are in operation throughout that region, right, for the U.S.,
Well, absolutely, and I want to refer people. In 2011, the day Mubarak was toppled, Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, wrote an excellent piece called millions of Egyptians have stood up, but the future remains unwritten. And he really captured the essential nature of what had happened and what it would take to actually bring forward a radically different future. And that is urgently needed because, as you're saying, that entire region is in tremendous turmoil. And imperialism in Israel are playing a big role. Reactionary nationalists like Bashar al-Assad are playing a big role. Reactionary Islamic fundamentalists are playing a big role. We need a revolutionary communist pole in the Middle East, in the mix in the Middle East, to give people a real alternative. And, of course, this is why, as you are, I'm a big advocate of Avakian's work and this new synthesis of communism, as well as his particular the particular piece, which is at revcom.us, on the situation in Egypt. And I will be posting something on Egypt as well in the next day or two at revcom.us.
All right, Larry, thank you very much for joining us today, and we will have you back. I'm sure the situation is going to demand a lot more attention to it right now, so we'll have you back very soon, all right?
Hey, take care, Michael.
All right,
thank you.
Thank you very much, man. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Larry Everest, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Rocking the U.S. Global Agenda. I want to thank my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, all of my guests, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, you can do that on Twitter and Facebook, and you can go to my blog, which is michaelslate.wordpress.com. And you can talk to me there, all right? And we're going out now with Revolution Rock from The Clash. Talk to you next week.
This year, Revolution Rock. Be careful how you move back. You dig me in the back. And I'm so pilled up that I rap out. I have got the sharpest knife, so I got the biggest slice. I got no time.